I guess it happens to us all at some time, doesn't it? The desire to write a gothic noir outback story. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ear Movies. Before you listen to Roadkill, I want to say from the outset that Collarenebri, if you've ever been there, is nothing like the Collarenebri of this story. True, I did stay there for a while, probably a bit longer than I thought I would, and yes, there was some cotton chipping and module building involved, which didn't pay as much as we were originally told, but there the similarity ends. So a big shout out to any listeners from Collie. Travis Spiteri has been on my radar for a long time. He's very talented, and I think you'll like him reading Roadkill. A quick warning, this story discusses some sensitive subjects. Please be mindful of your own mental health and reach out for help if you need to.
Roadkill. I wasn't sure how it ended up in Collarenebri. Well, that's not true. There was a girl, of course. There's always a girl, isn't there? She was sweet, but eventually we went our separate ways. You always do, don't you? That's not entirely 100% factual either. In reality, she went her way, and I stayed behind. I should have left then as well, but I didn't have a car anymore. An unfortunate accident with the kangaroo. It was more unfortunate for the roo, but that left me a long way from home. Not that I really had a home anymore. I had all my stuff in a dingy flat, no vehicle, and no one to call. Too many previous calls, you see. The Collie Pub is unremarkable, but that's being generous. It's a rundown small hotel by a small river on a small highway on the edge of a small town that hasn't had enough unkind words said about it. I may not be the most objective of witnesses, though. I'm bitter, you might say. Anyway, what I'm about to tell you started in the pub. It's not the only place to drink in Collie. There's the club as well. But that's another story. The pub is where I met Tonk. Think of the roughest country bloke you've ever met and start to multiply. A dirty trucker's cap, torn blue singlet, low-hung shorts that showed too much of his hairy ass, footy socks, scuffed old boots. A big bloke. I mean really big. Gut hanging down in front big. Uncaring that it had grown so huge. Possibly even proud of it. Front tooth missing. Shabby mouth covering moustache. Gravelly, grating voice with an endless parade of roomy, tired, stupid bad taste jokes. I won't bore you with them. You've heard them all before. And if you haven't, you're lucky. For some reason, he took a shine to me. Right then, stuck in a small town in the middle of a big nowhere, the attention he showed me meant he became the nearest thing I had to a friend. For a while, anyway. After we drank together a couple of times, he introduced me to others who were as lost as I was. There was Spike, who was only a shot away from becoming a heroin addict again. I'm pretty sure he managed his abstinence through sheer laziness. There was Jay, who was loud, sassy, and openly gay. He knew there were guys in town who'd bash him if he gave them half the chance, but he understood as well that if he didn't get in their face, they wouldn't be asked coming after him. And there was Hoppy, who'd smashed his car up one day going out to the cemetery. He was lucky not to have stayed out there permanently. The accident had stuffed up his leg, though. Over the weeks, Tonk somehow made us feel we belonged together. He practiced a naive and obvious form of manipulation, but when you're down on your luck and there's only one pub and the next town is a long way down the road and there's a big bloke saying he's always going to be there for you, well, it's amazing what you can accomplish. And after a few beers, when the stories started to flow and the laughs were tragically easy, when Tonk held forth like he truly had something of value to say, when the fear of returning to our dusty beds stalked us like a dingo in the dark, I guess we even felt safe. Briefly. We needed an income. For drinking, if nothing else. Tonk was, for Collarenebri, well connected. He knew who was hiring. One afternoon he told us he'd hooked us up to work on the cotton harvest. There's a bit of chipping first, then picking. We'll get the good bucks, don't you worry. Don't you worry was practically his catchphrase. Later, as soon as I heard it, I would literally start to worry. We drove out at 6 in the morning to a forgotten corner of Australia that someone had decided was the perfect place to grow 1 million acres of cotton. The problem was that in between the perfectly straight rows, a shitload of weeds had taken hold. Normally, you chip them out with a hoe in the summer when they're small, or you grow a GMO crop so you can just spray the crap out of them. But for whatever reason, neither had happened here. And they couldn't harvest with the weeds there because it meant they couldn't sell the cotton. So in the chill of the late autumn morning, we grabbed our hoes and started to chip out weeds which ranged in size from seedlings to meter-high triffids. At least we were out in the open. The air was clean and clear. It wasn't stupidly hot, nor was it too cold. We'd walk and hoe and talk and every few hours stop and eat cold meat sandwiches. Cold meat was all anyone ever put on sandwiches out there. And for some reason, lime cordial was our go-to drink. The sugar content, I guess. After chipping, the harvest began and I started module building. This meant I spent my day pressing cotton into a block that would later be loaded onto a semi-trailer to be taken to the gin for processing. I could control the back and forth and the up and down of the press, and that's all I did. For hour after hour. It was mind-numbingly dull. Back and forth, up and down, compressing the cotton. Back and forth, and up and down. The design of the module frame had the engine below the operator's platform, so it was noisy, and stank of diesel as well. The good news, I suppose, was that the job was intermittent. The car would break down, the weather wasn't right, Tonk had caught. When he first told me about the work, there were going to be endless days of it. Don't you worry, so much work that I actually saw myself saving enough to buy a car and leaving Collie forever. But it soon became apparent that this wasn't going to happen. My days were either spent module building or staring at the slowly orbiting ceiling fan of my dirty flat. The evenings consisted of drinking, and being that drinking cost more than either module building or ceiling fan staring earned, I began to borrow money. There was no paperwork needed at the Bank of Tonk. There was instant access to cash, and a bad credit rating was practically compulsory. There was one simple rule. Tonk held your card until payday. Once he'd withdrawn what you owed him, he'd hand it back with a flourish. Unless, of course, you owed more than you'd been paid. That wasn't a problem for him, don't you worry. But it meant you'd need to borrow more to cover your costs for the next week. It quickly became, you would say, a bloody vicious circle. Once the module building dried up, we moved on to stick picking, which is less interesting than it sounds. If a farmer wanted to put a scarifier over his land, it had to be free of logs and fallen branches, so he'd send in a team of blokes to clear it. You'd spend the day bent over, hauling wood to small piles that eventually became big piles. It was winter by then. Frosty mornings that left you craving the sun you cursed in summer. When you burned the piles, the warmth was never what you'd imagine it should be. And the yellow smoke held bitter memories. I'd been in Collie too long. Like the calendar had stolen time from me. Like it had ripped out whole days when I wasn't looking. There was probably a country and western song about it. But if there was, I didn't want to hear it. Then Christy rolled into town in her decaying Mazda. Everyone knew her except me. I think she'd been with Tonk on an earlier visit, maybe Hoppy on the one before that. I suppose it was kind of inevitable we'd get together. Loneliness takes many forms. I'm sure you've met women like Christy. The barbed wire voice from smoking since she was a child. Bright eyes, but worn skin. Faded tattoos. A laugh like a cockatoo. Disdain for eating, and a desire for drinking. Coldly calculating, or warm of heart in equal measures. She was a mother who'd never wanted children. She professed care for all, and yet showed genuine concern for very few. She was both sexless and sexy, depending on how many beers you'd had, and the light, and whether you'd argued earlier in the evening. We hooked up almost immediately. In places like Collie, if you're reasonably single, in close proximity, and there's nothing overtly pervy about you, then you'll probably give each other a go. It wasn't a romance that was meant to be, more a hookup that was meant to be convenient. We were complementary, in that I had a flat and an empty bed, while she had a car and an empty wallet. A match made in a place that had a different postcode to heaven. She had freckles. Late at night, with a nearly empty bottle of bourbon on our bedside table, a couple of dwarf candles flickering and the fragile spectre of hope sneaking out the back door, I would play join the dots on her back. I'd tell her of the fascinating creatures I was drawing, the impossible places I was seeing, and the amazing dreams I was sketching. She never tried to look at them. I suppose I might have been Van Gogh to her, or Monet, or any of them. The truth was, I was a lousy artist. She said she believed in my ability, but she was an equally lousy liar. I'd rub out the pictures in a sad nightly ritual. Perhaps she knew I was no good and didn't care. Or maybe she didn't know and cared a lot. It was an illusion of love which held us together only because we had a desire to be held together. It was a world where all the good things had run to other worlds and left behind their shadows to lie beside other equally unhappy memories. It was a long, dark road lined with roadkill. It was tragedy on a tragic scale. You think I'm being too harsh? You haven't heard Spike's stories of his days on the needle, or Hoppy complaining of the pain in his leg, or Jay's lonely laugh. You haven't had Tonk holding your card, and you haven't had Christy believing you're an artist. As if the dots on her back could be joined up to show a place where hope turned around and came back inside, and put its clothes away, and put the kettle on, and even pretended to smile. It was never a place our parents wished for us, but we didn't live in a world where parents cared anyway. After artwork in drawn and other forms, Christy and I would hold hands in the dark. It was the only honest thing we ever did together. One night in Bangkok, they say, is like a year in any other place. One night in Collie is much longer than that. At that stage, Tonk and I were still mates, so that made it easier. We had our little pub gang. Christy slotted straight in. She could be as loud and as opinionated as Tonk, so they were Mum and Dad. Hoppy, Spike and I were the stupid sons, and Jay was the cousin who took on the role of comic relief. I say that with all respect. He could be genuinely funny with just an eye roll. Sometimes he only had to twitch a lip. I used to wonder how, in that harsh environment, he managed to survive. It wasn't as if there was general approval of his sexuality, and it wasn't as if he attempted to hide it. Possibly he couldn't. I think part of it was that he belonged in Collie. It was where he'd been born. In that way, he faced the same economic issues, social isolation, and lack of services that everyone there did. I suppose his safety was due to an acknowledgement of shared experience. A few people genuinely liked him. Personally, I didn't care if he was gay or not. It just wasn't a concern for me. I'd had gay friends before, but he was the constant target of Tonk's jokes. If thinly veiled criticisms and muttered insults actually counted as jokes, I think Jay tolerated them out of habit. Sometimes I felt he even opened the door for Tonk to walk through because it was just expected of him. I think, looking back, Jay was managing the situation. We all suspected he was seeing someone, although no one knew who he was. I think this was eating away at Tonk. Christy's arrival didn't help the situation. She was protective of Jay, and after a few beers would get in Tonk's face, criticizing him for being intolerant. More than once I heard Jay defend Tonk. I couldn't tell why. First, he wasn't smart enough. Second, even in Collie, he couldn't just backhand her, not in public anyway. And Christy made sure she was never alone with him. But the more she got stuck into Tonk, the more she suffered for it. One morning she woke up to find her tires were slashed. Without a regular income, that's a big blow in Collie. That evening, Christy had been particularly harsh. So we knew the perpetrator was most likely the man who'd been sitting at our table buying us beers. Somehow, Christy and I scrounged up enough to get new tyres. It put me off standing up to Tonk, though. I was a piss-weak friend. Jay had been generous with his cash more than once, but I stayed silent as Tonk sat like the pompous, unlikable king of a small, dirty kingdom. "Who's for ring barking?" he asked in his harsh, wheezy voice. We dutifully nodded. "I need a full crew," Tonk said. "What about you, Christy?" "Where?" Christy asked eventually. "Three Pines," Tonk said. It was about 100 clicks down the highway. Not an unusual distance to travel for work in those parts. "They got a permit to clear?" Christy asked. Tonk glared. Christy was impassive. "I forgot to ask," Tonk said. "It pays okay though, don't you worry." "You pick your battles, don't you?" Christy sighed, deflated by a need for an income, more demanding than usual after paying for the tyres. Jay tapped the side of his glass. Spike and Hoppy stayed silent, but then they usually did. It should be noted that I avoided contributing to this conversation as well. That night, Christy was quiet. She let me touch her back and talk about what I saw there, but she wouldn't let me draw. I didn't care, because I didn't realise it was the beginning of the end for us. So much was to come, but looking back, it began to crumble that night. In the moment though, right there and then, when it's only a few drops of rain, you don't recognise the start of a flood, do you? The tipping point doesn't exist until you sail right past it. I didn't recognise it, but it was clear as dog's balls. It was as clear as the colour in a bright sky. It was as clear as the star maps on Christy's back. It was as clear as death following ring barking. Ring barking is when you cut the outer layer of bark so it stops the flow of water up the trunk. The tree dies over slow months. It makes it easier to bulldoze them later. It's depressing work. And we weren't helped by the weather, which turned grey as soon as we started. The endless clouds sat low and pregnant. When it rains out there, the dirt roads quickly become quagmires. You can easily become trapped. So we swung our axes with one eye on the sky. It's never a good idea not to pay full attention to your axe. Tonk wasn't that clever. He was more cunning than smart. But he could also become fixated. Things had been okay before Christie's arrival, but the change in the balance of power had destabilized him. He wasn't used to having his authority questioned. I think that's why he kept the pressure on Jay. Just about everything Tonk said to Jay now contained mention of the word arse. Jay would laugh his comments off or fail to react at all. This seemed to only make Tonk more determined. Christy ignored Tonk altogether, and that seemed to strengthen his resolve even further. Like he was looking for a reaction. He wanted to be acknowledged as our leader, and he was going to keep pushing until something eventually validated him. Out there in the cold air, under the leaden sky, we already felt threatened enough. The trees felt the frustration as we laid into them, murdering them unnecessarily harshly. We swung with anger. I wondered whether the threat of the rain was worse than the actuality of the rain. I came upon Christy boiling a billy. "Hey," I said. She grunted. I could see that Tonk was watching us from a distance. "Got one for me?" I asked. She grunted again as she poured from a blackened kettle into a battered mug. She squeezed in some condensed milk. There was ash floating on top of the tea. Perfect. "Tonk's a dickhead," she muttered. He was still watching us. Perhaps he was wondering if he should join us to cut off a potential insurrection. "Don't let him get to you, babe," I said. I still called her babe back then. "How can you let him talk to Jay the way he does?" she said. "Jay doesn't seem to mind," I said. I didn't believe it. "Jay's protecting himself," she said. "You need to do something." "Me?" I asked. "You want me to stand up to Tonk?" Like it was unprecedented. She turned away and poked the fire with a long stick. Tonk had walked over to Spike. They were too far away for me to hear what they were saying. Christy came close. She touched my sleeve.
"Come up from behind and king hit the asshole," she said.
I wondered how it would go. If I surprised him, I might get a couple of shots in. Sometimes that's all it took with bullies. Even big blokes like him, they'd back right off. Tonk was pretty hard though. I pictured him coming back at me. I could see his red, angry face. It'd be bad. Real bloody bad. Christy was now standing before a tree 200 meters away. She was preparing to swing her axe. I hadn't noticed her walk away while I'd been thinking about smashing Tonk. I looked over to him, still talking to Spike. He was a long way off too, but even from that distance I could see his eyes were still locked on me, as if daring me into action. In contrast, I could tell I'd completely vanished from Christy, even from her peripheral vision, like I'd stopped existing at all. She was hitting her tree with vigor, more determination and passion than I'd seen in her. I looked around. The smoke from the fire was barely penetrating the sky and hung around us like a shroud. Tonk was laughing. Spike was determinedly looking away. Christy swung her axe, the rhythm of her blows like the heartbeat of a dying man, slowing as she became tired. Hoppy was invisible, but I could hear him cough. Jay was in the center of us all, as if oblivious, but I think he was more conscious than anyone. He knows the danger is coming, I thought. He's running escape routes in his head, planning an exit, developing a survival strategy. The price of being different, I thought, although we're all different. The car ride back to Collie was tense. Tonk was holding forth about Souths, and which player Jay found the most attractive, with liberal mention of arse. Jay sat quietly, although he laughed loudly sometimes. Not at anything Tonk said in particular, just randomly, I suspected. Enough to keep him alive. Tonk was still painful at the pub later. Christy glared at him and me in equal measure. Spike and Hoppy spoke to each other in low murmurs, discussing the diff on Hoppy's car, a whine we'd all noticed on the drive back. Jay was quiet. Tonk started talking about our next job. He wouldn't tell us what it was, just that it'd be regular, good money, and easy. Don't you worry. Maybe this time there'd be enough for a ticket out. I looked to Christy, but I couldn't work out what she was thinking. She was a drifter, I knew, but I hoped that she'd drift alongside me for a while longer yet. It was a hope whose mother was numbness and whose father, already long separated, was routine. That's all it was in the end. A habit and an understanding that feeling nothing was better than feeling anything else on offer. It was a table set with empty plates and nothing on the stove. It came to a head on the Friday. On the surface, it didn't seem like much. Souths were playing Manly. An ancient rivalry, according to Tonk. Christy sniffed. She liked NRL as much as any of us, but she didn't care who won. She'd told me she just liked to watch the blokes getting tackled as hard as. She was funny like that. A pacifist, you'd say. Not an actual pacifist, of course. No one was out there. She'd stand up for herself if she needed to, go for it if necessary, but generally she'd prefer to sit back and watch. I'd seen her though, when they put UFC on the big screen. There was a look in her eyes. Sometimes too, in bed later. Let's just say I didn't mind it when the UFC had been on. Yeah. Tonk was a Rabbitohs fan, and Jay went for Sea Eagles. Tonk had started winding Jay up on the Tuesday. He was almost insufferable by Wednesday. On Thursday, Christy told him if he didn't shut up, she'd walk home. We were out by Pocketaroo, so I doubt she was serious. But like I said, she stood her ground where necessary, and for once, even Tonk got the message. On Friday, though, it was like the enforced silence the day before had charged his batteries. He was offensive. There's no other way to describe it. The whole drive out to work. All about Jay fancying this bloke or that one on the Manly team, and which way they preferred it. Heads or tails, Jay? Which one for him? He'd ask again and again as he worked through the entire Sea Eagle squad. Then a few from the other teams as well. And blokes from the past. Even some of the immortals. Christy had a go at Tonk once or twice, but this morning it was useless. He was unstoppable. I tried to change the subject by asking what the next job was going to be. Spike had asked as well, but Tonk just ignored us and went on and on with his tormenting. An emu sprinted out in front of us and Hoppy had to swerve. we nearly ran into the bore drain on the side of the road. It didn't entirely distract Tonk, but let's just say his focus shifted for a while into what an incredibly shit driver Hoppy was, and how it was lucky we weren't going to be limping like him if he'd had rolled it, which according to Tonk he so nearly had. It was Hoppy's turn to culprit for a while. The rest of us stayed quiet. What was the point of speaking up? It wouldn't stop Tonk, and most likely it would only deflect his attention onto us, and God knew, we all had enough flaws for him to do some damage. Christy took me to one side when we reached the paddock. "I'm gonna leave," she said. "You coming?" "Where are we gonna go?" I asked. "Dunno, Queensland somewhere. Cairns maybe. Get work on the prawn boats. I've heard it's good money." I thought about it. I'd never been up there. I'd never been on a boat either, truth be told. Well, the Sackville Ferry once, if that counted, and across the harbour a few times when I was a kid, but nothing else. Not even a tinny. It seemed like another world. A bloody long way from Collie, that's for sure. May as well think of going to Africa. "What do you reckon?" Christy asked. She was close to me. Closer than she'd been in weeks. "Dunno," I said. "Don't they have crocs up there? Poisonous jellyfish?"
"There's poisonous jellyfish everywhere," she said, looking at Tonk.
I didn't know what to say. And after a while, she moved away again. We went back to work. Some days it was easy to swing the axe. Other days it felt like it was made of lead. On the far side of the paddock, I could hear Tonk still going off at Jay about the footy. I looked up at the thick grey blanket above us. "Even the sky knows something's gonna give," I thought. I don't know how the sky knew what was happening down here on Earth, but this sky did. I put my head down and swung my axe. I went from tree to tree. I was relentless. After a while, I realized I couldn't hear Tonk anymore. Occasionally, I heard the sound of other axes hitting against timber, but they were faint. I was quite alone. I looked around. I was in a little tree-lined grove. Maybe I was the first bloke to ever walk here. I probably wasn't, but you never know, do you? There's probably parts of Aussie that are still untouched. They found those trees in the Blue Mountains. They reckoned no one had ever seen trees like them before. Not Europeans, anyway. Maybe anyone. Perhaps this little pocket I was in now was the same. I rolled a smoke. I lit it and looked around. It was pretty there, I guess. Some birds were going off. There were a few wombat burrows. Some dragonflies. The light was different, shining somehow, pure. In the distance I heard Tonk calling for me, but I didn't move. The birds went quiet. I could hear Tonk still yelling. I didn't care. I was happy where I was. Then I finished my smoke and went back to killing trees. After the ring parking, we moved on to the next job Tonk had for us. The one he'd built up. It was the roadkill contract. It was the worst one yet. We drove along the highway, stopping to pick up any animals that had been hit in the night. Because it was a long road, and this was harvest season, it meant there were a lot of trucks. Traffic and kangaroos weren't a good combo. Put it this way, we were pretty busy. One day when I was at work, Christy cut out on me. She left most of her stuff except her rings, a hair clip I knew she loved, and her favourite jeans. Like she'd selected the highlights of her life. Obviously I didn't make the list. I sat down on the bed as the realisation washed over me. It wasn't like we were in love. We had no plans to marry or anything like that. Just that it was going to be quieter in the evenings. I reckoned my pens would miss her more than I would. No more back to draw on. Not that we'd done that for a while. The next morning I chucked her things into the wheelie bin. It sat there until Wednesday, which was garbage night. Then I put it out on the street, and that was Christy out of my life. Tonk laughed his head off when I told him.
Like she ever stays, he said. I really hated him. The next morning, it was back to work as usual. The road was long and the dead animals were many. All I'll say is that you get used to it. Because we were out there daily, the bodies hadn't gone rotten. But it also meant we were stuck with Tonk for hours on end. He'd go on and on, insulting all of us, but mainly Jay. Sometimes when we picked up another dead roo to sling it in the back of the ute, you'd see the look on its face. Maybe I'm imagining it, but it seemed to be saying, why me? I don't deserve this. Well, I reckon Jay had the same look most days. There was nothing we could do about it, unless we wanted to wear the same look. We shouldn't have let it continue. We should have done something. But that would have required us to have been better people. And if we'd been better people, we wouldn't have been there, would we? We'd have been long gone. To North Queensland, maybe. Out on the prawn boats in the tropical sea. I drank too much one night, although I was drinking too much every night by then. On this particular morning, I was more fuzzy than usual, though. I hadn't undressed before going to sleep, so I just rolled out of bed when I heard the horn blaring. My mouth was dry. I wished I'd had time for a cuppa. I could think of better things to do than spend the day hauling dead marsupials around. Which is why, when I look back, I sometimes wonder if what happened next was all some kind of dream. Tonk was driving. Hoppy was in the front. Spike and Jay and I were in the back. I was thinking about spewing. It was Hoppy who spotted the carcass. We pulled over. Not that big, only a one-man job. Jay was on the passenger side. He jumped out. He reached the carcass, then signaled for us to come over. Tonk turned off the car, but made no move to get out. Go and see what he's on about, he ordered, lighting a smoke. He hadn't named any of us, but like the robots we were, we all got out of the car, leaving him sitting there. We walked over to Jay, and the lump of fur at his feet. What is it? I asked. What do you reckon? Jay wanted to know. We looked down. Is that what I think it is? Hoppy asked. Depends what you think it is, I said. My heart was racing, and already I had images in my head of money, of travelling to North Queensland, of finding Christy and a bright reunion. Looks like a flaming Tassie tiger, Hoppy said. That's what I think, Jay said. Jesus, said Spike. It was big enough. It had stripes down each side and the face of a dog. What do you reckon? Jay asked again. We're not in Tassie. I heard they once lived all over, I said. While this discovery had the chance to make us all briefly famous, and more importantly, a bit rich for a while, we all knew there was another part of the equation. Tonk? Spike asked. Jay shook his head. I reckoned I knew what he was thinking. Leave Tonk out of it, work it out some way so we could keep whatever money we got between the four of us. But then we heard the car door shut as Tonk started walking over. Jay had that look again, like he was about to be smashed by a semi. Tonk stared down for a minute, then shook his head. What are yous waiting for? He asked. What do you reckon? Hoppy asked. Tassie tiger, Tonk said. Yeah, I said. Tonk glared at me. Chuck the bastard in the back and let's get going, he said. Maybe he didn't realize its importance. Maybe our shared fortune was safe after all. It didn't ring true to me, though. If there was anyone with an eye for easy money, it was Tonk. He hadn't blinked when he'd recognized what it was. Something wasn't right. He doesn't want his photo in the papers, I thought. He doesn't want to be recognized. The usual routine when we finished for the day was to head to the tip. We'd dump our cargo in time for Seth Daniels to put the dozer over the top of it before he finished for the day. We weren't the only ones he catered for. Like other country dumps, you'd see all kinds of things there. Rotting cattle, rusty cars, the last shreds of hope, whatever people had decided to get rid of. I wondered what he'd say when he saw the tiger. Today, though, it was different. Tonk turned left at the 2 mile and headed down a track into the scrub. We knew enough not to ask him what he was doing. He told us to make a fire. Then he had Jay throw the tiger on it. I thought Jay was going to question him, but Tonk had had a look on his face like thunder since we'd picked it up. We watched its fur singe, then blacken completely as the body burned.
Tonk had us wait there until it was all gone. The smell of burnt animal in our nostrils forever. I wasn't sure what would happen next. If Jay would eventually go off at Tonk, or if it'd disappear completely like Christy. I knew it'd be the end of our little group. We operated because of balance. If that was removed, we wouldn't survive. To tell the truth, I didn't really care because I was drinking pretty heavily by now, even by my recent standards. I should have been strong and been the instrument of change, but I just got pissed every night and waited for something to happen. I'd been taking a few days off work. Jay and I got on it one day, drinking beer after beer we couldn't afford. I thought about talking to him about how Tonk was picking on him, but I couldn't even do that. I was concerned he might ask me to intervene. Tonk and Spike and Hoppy turned up to the pub early. There'd only been a light overnight massacre on the region's highways. No unexpected appearances of allegedly extinct fauna to muddy the waters either. Tonk glared at both me and Jay when he saw us. When he spoke, he directed all his attention to Hoppy and Spike. That was actually fine with me. Jay left early. Tonk took the opportunity to throw a couple of particularly vicious barbs at him as he left. Jay pretended not to hear them, although he knew he must have. For half a second, I wondered whether this would be the night he'd fight back. It wasn't. Right at that point, full of piss and a little bit of watery vinegar, I ran scripts in my head for my own version of defiance. I even turned to Tonk, but found him staring at me, as if daring me. Then I had an image of a dead wombat being thrown into the back of the truck. I could see myself heading the same way. I didn't say anything and took another drink instead. Tonk smiled his twisted grin. The bastard thinks I'm on his side, I thought. For all the challenge I put up to him, I damn well was. I should have just gone into the night and had a go at Jay myself. A few weeks later, Tonk lost the roadkill contract. Most likely he stuffed it up. We'd missed a few days here and there after all. We moved on to a new job, taking down the trees growing under the power lines. It was supposed to pay well, don't you worry. We were working with another crew. They operated the cherry pickers and chainsaws while we cleared up the fallen branches. We dragged them to an ancient rusty wood chipper, which bellowed and shook as it sucked them in and ground them into pulp before spewing them into the back of a truck. There was something fascinating about the way even large branches became no more than eucalypt-scented flying dust. Tonk reckoned he'd been trained to operate the chipper, so he didn't have to do much more than stand there and yell unnecessary orders. We worked steadily all morning, and then it happened. The split second where everything changed. Jay was struggling to move a gnarly old branch. It was twisted and large, and I went to help him, but Tonk called me off, yelling that it didn't need two of us. Jay kept dragging it by himself. I went to the next, about 20 meters away. Hoppy and Spike were already around the corner, so they didn't see what happened next. But I did. Jay struggled to get the branch lifted up so Tonk could feed it into the chipper. Tonk leaned forward and lifted it, no worries. Like it was nothing, just shoved it in. The chipper screamed. The branch jerked like it was in cardiac arrest. In a final desperate spasm, it twisted enough to snag Tonk's belt. Suddenly he was off balance and falling towards the machine. Being dragged by the branch, he was going to get sucked right into the chipper. He smashed his hand down onto the safety switch. Nothing happened. It must have been broken. You could see he was terrified now. He knew they'd be sifting through the wood chips to find all the little bloody scraps of him. I was too far away to do anything. Jay was close enough, though. What would he do, I wondered? Would he save his tormentor? I doubted I'd have done anything. It was a convenient accident, in my opinion. Just let it be, and after the chipper did its work and Tonk was gone, we could start again. But Jay didn't hesitate. He sprinted over. Tonk was nearly in the machine, one hand stretched towards it desperately trying to unhook himself. Jay grabbed the other. He saved him, I thought. No. Those machines are strong.
Tonk was hauled right inside. I thought he'd yell, but he stayed silent. The machine cried out instead. Jay was still holding on to Tonk's other hand. He didn't let go. By now, I'd started running, wanting to save Jay. Was he still desperately trying to save Tonk by pulling back on his hand when it was already too late? Or was Tonk, in some fiendish way, just not letting go of Jay? Whichever it was, I couldn't do anything. I watched as Jay also went straight through the chipper. Both instantly vaporized. I was the only one to see it, possibly the only person ever to see anything like it. That few seconds that Tonk and Jay flew from the chipper through the air as bloody mist. The most amazing rainbow. Salmon in hue. The most grotesque symbol of hope you can imagine. Like it was a signal to me. You are not trapped here. You can find Christy. You're finally free. I couldn't leave straight away, though. There were the funerals, and then Spike getting back on the gear and ODing, and Hoppy getting back on the grog and stacking it against the tree on the road to Walgett one night. All of them gone, just like that. I thought of Christy, who I reckoned was kicking back in Cairns by now. I wondered if she thought of me sometimes. I hoped she was missing me playing Join the Dots on her back, and holding hands in the dark. But I didn't go to her to find out. Instead, I stayed in Collie. I run my own crew now, doing all the same dirty jobs we used to do with Tonk. I do my best to look after the blokes, don't you worry. Davo, who's as thick as two shore planks, I make sure is reminded of it regularly. TJ has the black teeth of a hardened ice addict, but he reckons he's off it now. I give him grief about it though, to keep him in his place, because he tends to mouth off otherwise. And then there's Mouse, who's a royal pain in the ass. He's got a limp, but I reckon he's faking it. I pay out on him to keep him in line, but one day, I reckon I'm gonna have to go harder. Jeez, he shits me.
That was Travis Bateri reading Roadkill. It was recorded on Gadigal land at King Sound Studios in Surrey Hills, Sydney. Thanks, Nick and Joe. Trevor Brown composed the theme music. Check out the Ear Movies website for the incidental music details. Please like the show and follow it on whatever platform you're using to listen to it. It'll make a big difference. Ear Movies are written and produced by me, Simon Luckhurst. Thanks for listening.